Survivor's Guide to True Crime includes discussions of sexually based violence and is not intended for children. Information provided should not be used as a substitute for professional medical or legal advice. Please exercise discretion and self-care. Welcome back to Survivor's Guide to True Crime. I'm Kim.
And I'm Kara.
Today we have an amazing guest that I am really excited to be sharing with everyone because this is somebody that I have followed for a long time and finally got to connect with, and it was like, oh yes, of course. I feel like I know them. And then is that a parasocial relationship when you're interacting? I don't know. Does that count?
I think so. I don't know. I mean, so this was actually my first introduction to Cheyenne, our guest for today. And I loved it. I love all of our interviews. I say this every episode. I'm like, it was such a good interview. And I'm like, every interview is good or else we wouldn't do it.
And I never get done with one and I'm like, oh, that could have been better. No, it was awesome. We are thankful for their time and just the work that Cheyenne has put in to what she's going to talk about today and her humble, incredible energy. I'm just so happy that she shared her heart and her work with us. So Cheyenne Wilson, a BSN, is the author of We Are the Evidence, a handbook for finding your way after sexual assault. And she's on a mission to raise awareness about the reality of sexual assault, eliminate the stigma associated with being a victim of this violent crime, and make lasting changes in the justice and healthcare systems.
Cheyenne earned her bachelor's in psychology and worked in social services before pursuing a career in nursing.
And we're going to let her tell you in her own words about herself and the work that she does. So here is our conversation with Cheyenne.
I'm really excited that you're here. So full disclosure, we have followed each other for many years now and finally got the chance to connect on, I think, just Zoom a couple weeks ago or so. And it was instantly like, yes, we speak the same language. And I knew that I wanted to have you come on to our second season with the new book that you've put out and all of the incredible work that you do on behalf of survivors. So thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And yes, following each other for a long time. I think it's a good reminder that the people on these platforms are actual people, because I look at all these accounts I'm following. I'm like, they're so incredible and amazing. I can't reach out to them. I'm so nervous. And then you're like, oh, like they are people. Like they're just someone else. And yeah, super grateful that we were able to connect. Thank you. And thanks for having me on the show.
So we always start off with a little icebreaker. And we pre-recorded a little bit of content for our Patreon. So we've kind of already broke the ice, and that's available over there once this episode airs. But tell us what your current binge is, whether that is a series or book series or podcast, whatever it is that you are currently binging.
I'd say Fourth Wing, which we talked about a little bit too this morning already. I started it and it's been on my like to be read shelf for forever. And I kept like rejecting reading it. And sometimes I think I know I'm going to get too invested. And so I don't want to get involved. But I binge read that. And in fact, like I loved it so much, I had to order like same day delivery for the second one because I don't like going out in public. So I was like, please be delivered to my door so I can start that right away. So that's kind of where I'm binging right now.
That's the ultimate like book delivery dream too. I don't want people.
Are you finding that you're making it through the second book slower than the first?
Yeah, which I was warned that would happen. So it's okay. I still have enough momentum from the first one. Hopefully it'll carry me through and the dialogue from the dragons will keep me going no matter what. So
I was surprised by that. And it wasn't because I didn't like the second book. And it's not because it's slower necessarily. There's just a lot more happening. And it's like you have to process it a little bit slower. But I loved it so much that I told my husband about it and he's actually read it. Oh. And it's the first time that he's read any of like the kind of books that I read where it's, you know, like
smut,
fantasy smut. Yeah. And he's like, oh my God, you read this? And I was like, isn't it great? And he's like, it's so graphic. And I was like, this ain't nothing.
I haven't heard this from my best friend yet, so I'm going to need to text them as soon as we're done here. Joe and I are best friends.
I was like, I thought I told you're talking about him.
Yeah. Well, all right. Mike doesn't really read for pleasure anymore. That's funny. Double entendre. But he doesn't really read just for fun because he has to read so much at work. And it used to read a ton. Bookshelf back here is all World War II history because that is like, that was his major in pre-law and all.
That's what you do whenever you hit a certain age as a man, though. or get really into World War II history or smoking meats or sometimes both.
It's both and IPAs. And I'm just putting him on blast here. Sorry, but he also is now wearing jorts, unironically. I got him for an 80s party and he's just wearing them every single day.
That doesn't surprise me because he relaxes in jeans. Right. He's like questionably.
So anyway, if anybody has any intervention advice, is that in your handbook?
Ooh, that's dangerous. You created a monster with your Halloween outfit.
I will say that the author of Fourth Wing lives down in Colorado Springs, about a 2-hour drive away. And when I finished the book and realized that there wasn't another one yet, it took everything in me to like, don't be that girl that drives down and is like, hey, what you doing? We've all seen Misery. We don't need to go that route. But I did just see on her Instagram, she finished and sent off her first draft of the manuscript for the third one.
Yay!
That's exciting.
Similarly to you, Cheyenne, I waited to read it because I knew that I was going to be ravenous for the second book. So I waited until the second book was out. And so I purchased both at the same time. It's like The Throne of Glass. That's my favorite
series ever to ever exist.
I agree. I think Throne of Glass, like people are like, oh, Court of Roses and whatever. And I'm like, no, I'm like Throne of Glass. I bought the entire series on Kindle. Like it's one big Kindle book. So I didn't even have to like go out of the book. I just straight through all of it.
I powered through and then I stopped. Like I drug my feet through because I did Tower of Dawn and Empire Storms tandem read like they have. And I drug my feet because I did not want to get to Kingdom of Ash because I was not ready for it to be over. So I like sped read and then stopped and like took me almost like a year because I just didn't want it to be over. But
my problem is I listen to all of these on audiobooks. Like, because I can't.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Is that weird?
2x speed, pretty fast.
But like, that's the speed of my inner monologue and my brain. And if it's going slower than that, I'll lose interest. This is a good question. Poll, what speed do you listen to audiobooks on or podcasts on? And is that different?
My partner is a 2x speed person and it sounds way too annoying for me. I need it 1x.
Yeah. I do about 1.25 speed on most books, podcasts, straight through, unless they talk like this. Now, there are some TikToks. I'll speed those up a lot of the times when people are talking. But yeah, it's like it increases the sound to a level that hurts my brain.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's a stimulation thing for me too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If I am listening at that speed, it's something like romance. I don't have to get every single word, but like it bringing us back to your book too. If I were to listen to something like this, it would probably be at 1.25. I know that I will have to back up and jump back and forth and listen to. So let's segue, because we've established we don't do those, but let's segue. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your story to whatever your comfort level is. And then we're going to get into this very beautiful piece of book. And I'm so excited.
Thank you. And feel free to jump in with questions too. But my name's Cheyenne. I'm the founder of We Are the Evidence and the author of We Are the Evidence. Yeah, I'm also a nurse. So while I was writing the book, I was also in nursing school. And it was crazy because I graduated and took the NCLEX within like the same month that I turned in the final manuscript for the book. And to be honest, I'm still trying to figure out what it means to be a nurse and an author afterwards, kind of adjusting to like those new roles. But I've been working in advocacy for a while, whether it's through social work or the Instagram platform for a very long time. And then I guess my story. So the book came to be because I experienced sexual assault in college. And after my assault, I was really confused because there's someone I knew and I knowingly went to their like dorm. And like, I always thought in my head that I would react differently in that situation. I always thought I'd be the person to go very physical aggression, attack. And yeah, like I'd rather die than be sexually assaulted. That's what I thought I would respond like. And so when I didn't, and I froze more than anything, I was so confused. And I went looking for resources on, was this sexual assault? Was it rape? Like, did I ask for this? Was this my fault? So I went to the school library and I remember going to like those old computers you used to look up and typing in like sexual assault. And the things that came up were like 50 Shades of Grey. And then there was a book from like the 50s that I went and looked at. And it was like, make sure you wear long skirts and like carry pepper spray or something like that. And I was like, okay, like I don't know what it was. And I disclosed to a couple people who didn't respond supportively. So that didn't help because they also were thinking sexual assault was like a stranger that you didn't know and that it couldn't be someone you did know. So I didn't report. I didn't seek help. I just kind of buried it down deep. And it wasn't until a couple of years later that I was looking at, for just more information on sexual assault. And I came across this document that said what rape myths were. And I was trying to educate up-and-coming prosecuting attorneys. And I was so angry to see most sexual assaults were committed by someone the person knows. And like that one sentence, I can still see it, and I'm not even a visual memory person, was so validating and frustrating and made me so angry. And I was like, okay, knowing that, let's do more research. So I did more research and I ended up reporting and going through the whole process. And I knew before I even made it to court all the way that this book needed to exist because how many more people were like me? Because they didn't know any different and other resources, they didn't seek healing or reporting. So yeah, I knew it needed to exist. And I remember being really upset because I was like, I have the resources to like look into this more, but what about people who don't have the resources and access to do that? How can I make it more accessible to them? So I've been dreaming about this book and working on it since, let's see, like 2016, 2017, a long time. So it's wild that it exists now and it's available.
That's so amazing. And I think it's going to be so validating for so many people who will also find themselves in your shoes. They will see themselves in this story because as people who have worked in this arena, who are in this world, we know that those statistics are true. Mm-hmm. So very often, Kim and I will get asked questions about our experiences with our sexual assaults. And they may not resonate with a lot of people because it was strangers. So for us, for instance, one of the things that I often get asked, I'm sure both of you, when you share your story, get asked, is how we differentiate a consensual relationship with our assaults. And for me, it's very clear cut, right? Because it was a stranger. There's not a level of overlap. But I know very often for people who have some level of relationship, whatever that looks like, with the person that is also their offender, things can get murky. And so I think it's important for us to have people sharing stories that are different for that reason.
And that place of quiet and shame is where guilt or victim blaming thrives. So when we're not talking about it, people are taking that on themselves to say, well, nobody else is experiencing this and therefore it must be my fault. So you putting not only your experience into words, but into print is a huge accomplishment that I cannot possibly overstate. It is amazing.
Yeah, thank you. So the book has very little of my story in it. And it's interesting because, and we can talk more about the book writing process, but for a long time, I didn't want to have any of my story in it. And I didn't want my name to be tied to the book. I wanted to use a pen name and I wanted to be completely removed from it because I just wanted to create this resource. And it's been the most like empowering and challenging experience because my name had to be part of the book. That was part of, in order for it to be in existence. Like letting myself not be hidden anymore and letting myself and my story be out there. And I learned this leading up to the book launch that something that was taken away from me during my assault was my confidence in being seen. And I've spent so long trying not to be seen. And so the book really has been a challenge because I'm being seen and getting used to that and getting used to being okay with sharing my story more. But the book also has 5 other survivors who share their stories. And those are really powerful, impactful. And the audiobook, which I love, if you guys like audiobooks, has, they gave us the opportunity to read our own section when we were recording. And so most of the experts and survivors read their own section and hearing them share their story, like makes me cry. It's so beautiful and powerful. But yeah, the ability to share your story is huge.
God, and what a way to reclaim your actual voice in a studio like that. Oh my gosh, I love it.
Now I have to buy the audiobook too. I just bought the book and because I'm like, I like to consume content like this in an actual book so I can slow down and process it. But now I'm like, no, I got to buy the audiobook too because I want to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a physical book person, but I have listened to the audiobook just because it's amazing. I love hearing the voices and I'll skip around to the experts. So you'll hear all these different voices and it's just fun like hearing everyone share their expertise.
I love that. Maybe it's a tandem read situation. You have to buy both now, people.
One of the things that I loved about this too is that when Kara and I were thinking through Survivor's Guide to True Crime and finally landed on a name, it sounds a lot like it's encompassing or filling the gap that you knew existed
when you were going through this on your own and you were having to make your own guide. So leaving those breadcrumbs behind and publishing something that will help other people pick and choose what their path may be aligned perfectly with this. And I love it because so... For those of you who can actually see it or are watching on Patreon, the book is clearly beautiful. We're going to link it in our show notes. We'll see lots of things that are going to be shared from Cheyenne as well. I don't want to crease it. I took this with me on my work trip to St. Louis, and I'm like trying to read like without without creasing it because I need to take a picture with this, number one. And number two, I use Post-its and write in margins and highlight and dog ear and beat the crap out of my books. But that's exactly like, that's what we do to ourselves as we're moving through our stories, right? Like we have to make notes in the margins and sometimes we need to go back and reread something and that is okay. I think that what I have gathered from We Are the Evidence is that this isn't a one and done read. You can use this as a reference manual over and over for different phases in your life too.
Yeah, that's really what I pictured it being. I remember kind of modeling it after What to Expect When You're Expecting, like jump to what you need. And it was really cool because someone purchased the book and tagged me in their story saying they purchased it specifically to get tips on how to write your victim impact statement. And I was like, perfect. Like you can be wherever you're at in your journey, get what you need from the book and then set aside till you need something again. That's really the vision I have.
I love it so much. I can't wait to read it.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys' support so much.
So talk to us about the process of writing the book, getting to the publishing, and what that felt like for you as a survivor to share your story, put it out there, but kind of relinquish the control of the process too.
Oh, that control piece with writing and publishing is huge. And I'm fortunate. Balance, which is the publishing house for my book, was very good at communicating and very good at letting me have control and say, which I know is not the case for a lot of people when they go through this process. They were incredible to work with, which I should back up and say that before it got picked up by a publishing house, it was rejected by another one. And they said that people who were sexually assaulted would not go looking for a resource because if you've been sexually assaulted, you're just going to go to the cops. That's it. And like the shock I felt at how ignorant that is. And I was like, okay, even if you believe that to be true, don't you think the cops want a resource to be able to hand out? Like, why? It still like makes me mad.
Really, that was a man that said that.
It was a woman.
What? Shut the... No way.
It was, yeah. Mm-hmm. It was a woman.
Please. Yep. I will pay money to send your book to this woman, please.
Which is interesting because I don't know if you guys have heard something similar, but I remember going to court and them saying that women are tougher to have on juries for sexual assault cases because they're harder on other women than men are, which is interesting. And the publishing team I have is all women. I have an all-woman publishing team, so like very supportive. But yeah, that shock that a woman said that sexual assault survivors wouldn't go looking for resources is wild.
Well, and how lucky is she to not have clearly that firsthand experience or to not know, but it also makes me sad for the women in her life that won't feel comfortable going to her if they did anything outside of going straight to the police.
Exactly. Yep. So that's wild. But yeah, there's like a lot of control that had to be given up. And so the original vision I had for the book got completely scrapped. And I remember being told like, this isn't the best resource the book could be. You have to redo the whole thing. And that devastation and like PTSD trigger of losing control and having to start over was really hard. And I went through that several times. So writing the book was incredibly helpful in me learning that I don't have control and I need to trust other people. And I can allow other people to help and support me. Like there are experts who do this for a living who know what's going to be the best outcome and product while balancing that with my voice and knowing like, no, this is what survivors want. Because there's a couple sections in the book that got cut and a couple that wanted to be cut. And I had to say, absolutely not. Like I know this section's really important. So I learned a lot on how to give up control while still seeing my voice and advocating for myself and what I felt was really important. But with the book, there's a ton of opportunities where you had to give up control. Because even with the cover, which I now love, like there were so many feelings around creating the image for the cover that I wanted and trusting someone else to create it. Coming up with the name, there was always this fear that they were going to rename the book. Because that's the common thing that you hear is that ultimately the name is up to the publishing house if you go traditional instead of self-publishing. And I'm very attached and feel very strongly that my name is the message that like I want. So all these opportunities for that lesson.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the barriers that you bumped up against? And we had talked about this a little bit before, but what are the things that you saw? Because I know that it's simultaneously pushing your buttons as a survivor, but advocating for yourself as an author as well. What were some of the other barriers to getting that published?
And we talked about this a little bit already too, but I had to have a platform for myself. I had to show that I was the person who should write this book. And that was the biggest part. And honestly, it's something I'm continuing to work on because there was this huge piece of, are you the person we should choose to write this book? And showing that, yes, I am. When I'm not an expert in law or medicine or therapy, I'm a survivor who has experience and I have done a lot of research. But I had to show like, yes, choose me to write this book and to create this resource. And that was really hard. And it's kind of an ongoing thing now. Like I feel like I constantly have to prove myself that I don't have imposter syndrome over the book. Like I was able to create a resource. Mm-hmm.
That was exactly the word that came into my mind is imposter syndrome, because we experience this as survivors all the time. And to have that wrapped up in whatever work we do, whether that is going and working for someone in a corporate setting, whether it's being the best parent or spouse or human that you can be at home, we always feel like we are not enough mm-hmm. because in action, we have been told that we're not by someone else who raped, assaulted, molested. Any of those crimes against us, our personhood, our body, we are told that we're not enough and we're not good enough. And so I don't even know how to eloquently say this, but this is all about the rebuilding process. And that's something everyone across the board is going to understand and see. And it doesn't matter where you are in that rebuilding process, but knowing that you can find the tools, whether it's this book or whether it's a podcast or whether it's fellow survivors or just allies. They all are going to help us rebuild. And we're going to be in your corner cheering very loudly and reminding you that you are a badass. You absolutely are the right person to have written this book.
Thank you. And that's been the biggest gift of writing the book is the network I've been able to build and the connections I've made, without a doubt. Like I'm constantly like sitting in a bunch of gratitude from that specifically.
And I feel like one of the unique things about this particular type of book, this particular community, is I feel like no one builds you up and supports you quite like the women who have been through some shit.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
And we're like, yeah, yeah, you bad ass bitch, we see you, let's go. Like, so
that's the girls that we're looking for all the time. So one of the things that you had told me was some important advice that you had gotten from your book coach. Can you share that with everyone?
Yeah. So one thing going through the book and writing it that I'm super grateful to have a book coach for is she pointed out to me that every single sentence has to be able to stand on its own. So every sentence you write, if you pull it out of context, how does it read and what does it look like? And so when writing the book, we had to go through every little detail, like how does this sentence sound on its own, which was really helpful for me also moving forward just in life and as a survivor.
Automatically, my brain goes to that's how survivors live every single day. Every single thing that we say can be taken apart or construed. And especially when you're talking about moving through a court system, every sentence in that mm-hmm. affidavit, every sentence that you've given in an interview or talked to someone or text message you've sent, they can be completely innocuous. But if they're taken out of context, it is always twisted and worked against the victim. And that is depleting and tiring and exhausting. But that's where our brains are constantly at. And so to do that in writing, what did you see?
That is hard. Like you don't realize how much you write or even in conversations, what you say and how easily things can be pulled out, which is something that I really believe about your mission here with the podcast is letting victims have control over sharing their story. Because that's true. Like victims and survivors, no matter where they're at in court or when their story is being told by mass media, every sentence is taken out and looked at and evaluated. And that's really hard and exhausting. It's so exhausting to think that way and to write that way.
So let's talk a little bit more about your platform, the content that you're putting out there, the content of the book. Let's talk about, I know one of the things that we have written down that is something that you speak about is sexuality and how that is affected by being a victim of a sexual assault. So let's kind of dive into this. Let's get into the meat of this.
Yeah, that's something I'm really passionate about because I think, at least for a long time, the idea was if you've been a sexual assault survivor, you're not going to date, you're going to be hyposexual, you're going to have a very low sex drive. And so people are really confused if they have any kind of reaction that's opposite of that. And they think it's harder for them to process their trauma and harder for them to say, yes, I was sexually assaulted because they throw themselves into being hypersexual or sometimes start to explore alternative lifestyles that they think coincides with maybe they did deserve to be sexually assaulted. It's really complex. And I'm very passionate about making sure people know that there's all kinds of responses to trauma. And sometimes it's not hyposexuality. Sometimes you might become hypersexual. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about that.
That's something we've touched upon before, but it always bears repeating too. I feel like anyone who is victimized, especially while you are in a brain development stage, is going to seek out those consensual actions to prove to themselves that they have that power. They have that control over that act. The missing piece is consent. It doesn't matter what you are acting and what you are doing, but normalizing that process. And I have jokingly said before, you know, I went through my slut era where I'd make out with randos at the bar right afterward. But that was me saying, see, I can do this. I'm fine. I'm fine. And that's really, really common, but it's looked at as a reflection of you and how you are coping instead of, hey, this is a response to a massive trauma that upended my entire life.
Yeah, you can get your power back by taking power back of what you feel like is your body and your sexuality. Yeah, that's big and it should be talked about more.
And I think the more that we have these conversations, the more people will feel seen because, like you said, there's not a ton of resources out there. And so one of the things that we can get asked often is about our sexuality, right? And people can be surprised by our response. So I am the kind of person that I've actually learned this about myself, Kim. I don't think we've talked about this. I intellectualize my feelings. So it's hard for me to process how I feel about things because I'm just intellectualizing things. I'm just thinking, okay, so why? What is the mechanism behind someone becoming asexual, basically, you know, after an assault? What is the mechanism behind hypersexuality? Is that something that like you had experts consult on for the book or what does that process look like? I would love to hear because I need to know the whys.
I wasn't able to get an expert to talk about that specifically, which was something I was really trying to get, but wasn't able to for this edition, but I'm hoping the second edition. Because I'm not quite sure either why some people become like more asexual or hyposexual and some become very hypersexual. I think it's very similar to the idea of why some people decide suddenly to wear very baggy clothes. And some people want to not be seen. And that might look like not having sex, not letting people get intimate with them in that way. And this is all just me guessing, where other people, it's very much like, I want to show I have that consent and that power back. So my guess is maybe it's a battle between like wanting to show power versus not being seen and which one you kind of fall more towards, what feels safer for that person.
This popped up. I've been doing a series of interviews for some things and it's getting like into the nitty gritty of my memories, my assault, and things that like I don't think of because I don't have to, maybe they weren't part of the court process or they aren't in affidavits, but it's how I responded, especially in those moments after, months after, year after, that otherwise I just sort of forget about. Yeah. And I found my planner from 2006 and it's written with color coding and all of the things and every day is completely full. And then you get to May 12th and there's nothing. And so that was really interesting to look at, but the things that were already scheduled are still in that planner. And I flip to the next week, 1 week after my assault. Kara, I don't know if I've told you this or not. I did the Hooters swimsuit competition 1 week afterwards. And I don't know why I didn't remember that. Like I know I did it, but I didn't realize it was so quickly afterwards. And when I started thinking about it, I'm like, yeah, well, that doesn't impact me. I can go out and do it. He had not been caught yet. They didn't know who it was. Again, light bulb. They had officers that were staged around that whole facility trying to see if there was anyone that matched the description, if he would have come to that event. So those things like completely left my brain. And I always think about that when, you know, you're going through a book like yours, if those are going to pop up, you know, you jokingly said your therapist upped your stuff to once a week. Good on you both because there are so many things that are going to come out of this. And yeah, Kara and I have a platform. You have a platform. We talk about these things all the time. They are embedded into our everyday conversations, but most people aren't. Most people, they have to seek out that space to talk about it. It's not just, I'm going to drop a text in the group chat and this is totally normal because I'm the most random friend. But this is something that it constantly happens for people. They just don't always say it out loud or process it. Like Kara, you're saying, like it's a different type of processing for everyone. What have you found through the course of the book or your journey through survivorhood has been really impactful to you?
So when I went to court, because I didn't ask very many people to come support me because it was a state away, because assault happened in a different state than I lived in. So I had a very small, small group of people who were there sitting for me during this process in the courtroom. And my perpetrator had his grandma and his girlfriend and his brother and like all of his friends on his side. And so that doesn't feel good, like to be testifying and see like him and his grandma specifically. And then no one really on my side. But the detective on my case, Shelley Fisher, who advocated so hard for me, you guys. Like I know not everyone has this experience, but she advocated so hard. She took my case and kept bringing it to the district attorney's office. I was like, you guys have to like look into this. Like you have to talk to her. And just kept bringing it up. And I'm so grateful to her for advocating for me. But she asked her coworkers to be on the side of the galley for me. And like I said, it's like one of the few things I get emotional about is seeing this room full of people who are there to support me, even though they didn't fully know me, that she had asked to be there. Yeah, she was just so supportive throughout the process. And I reached out to her when I was writing the book and she agreed to be one of the experts. So she contributed to the book. And I mean, all the experts are amazing, but that one specifically because she was on my case. And she talks about delayed reporting specifically, which is super personal to me because I was a delayed reporter. It took me years to report. That's so special. And then the assistant district attorney, he wrote one of the first endorsements for the book before the book was even out. He got a copy and yeah, it's incredibly special to have that kind of support from those two individuals.
I love that. Well, and what a testament to when people who are in the criminal justice system respond by believing and have that empathetic victim-centered response. Look at the three of us sitting right here are products of professionals who started by believing. And I love that you're still in contact and they're still doing that work to help other people too.
Mm-hmm. And I remember hearing your guys' story and hearing the same thing, that you guys had that support and belief. It makes such a difference. I don't think the book would exist without it.
Yeah. And I think it's such a good reminder and a good testament to one of the things that I do a lot of keynotes to law enforcement specifically. And the things that I remind them of is how small the actions are for them and how profound they can be for the survivors they work with. Because for her, that wasn't a lot of extra work for her to do that, right? But what a profound impact it made. And how choosing our words, choosing our actions, once we know the impact, how much we can do with that. I think it's so important to remember that. And it doesn't just apply to people who are in law enforcement, people who, you know, work in these fields. It applies to all of us who may have someone disclose. Yes, absolutely start by believing, but there's just so many other little things that we can do that can have these profound impacts on creating survivors.
Yeah. And the assistant district attorney did exactly that also, because I met him and he told me, he's like, I've seen cases win with a lot less to go on than yours. And I've seen cases lose that have a lot more. So like, we don't know how this is going to go. There's a lot of variables, but he gave me the choice. He's like, do you want to move forward? And if you do, I will fight with you. And if you don't, like, we'll just explore other options so that you feel like you're still getting the support you need. And that choice meant everything. Like I never at any point in time felt like I had lost control over making that choice specifically. Of course, the court process and all that is all kinds of like, you have no control, which is stressful, but like that choice meant everything. Like he gave me choice where he could.
Sorry, I'm in my feels over here. I have heard so many awful stories about botched investigations or just a lack of care from everyone. And so when I hear so many negative stories, that to hear these positive stories do still exist and they are based on those seemingly small actions that make all the difference. Those are the things that we can continuously teach to everyone in your everyday life. We never know what someone else is going through.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Give people choice and do the small things you can and check in with them. Like keep checking in. That was something the detective was amazing about too. She constantly was checking in like, hey, how are you doing? Those three things can make such a difference in a survivor's world.
Yeah. Did you have, and this is me personally wondering, did you have that watershed moment where you realized, like bouncing back to the book, this is happening. Like I feel as though Kara and I operate in a place of cautious optimism constantly. Like that is, I didn't pick a word for the new year, but if I had one, it was cautious optimism, where I don't know how it's going to turn out and I'm not hinging my healing on it, but it could be really cool if it did. Did you have that moment where you realized it's happening?
I think I constantly have that moment. Yeah, I'm so proud of this resource and I get to see it helping people. And I constantly, every time I get a message from someone saying like, this book made a difference for me, or this book gave me a resource, or this book would have been everything I needed after my assault, I have that moment again, like, oh my gosh, it's real. Like the book I was looking for, the book I needed is out there and people have it now. Like people can get it. And we talked about this, but like I need to have better boundaries about not just sending it to everyone. Cause I'm like, if it can help one person, it makes all the difference. And to know it's helped multiple people is huge.
That has always been my go-to as well. And for what it's worth, we see you and we love what we see, what we hear, who you are. I cannot thank you enough. And that actually brings us to your call to action. Can you tell us and our listeners how they can get involved? What would be the one thing that you want them to do?
I would ask that you call your local library or community or college library and ask them to carry the book. I feel very strongly in this because I recognize that barrier to people buying or having the book is bringing it home, where your abuser could be someone who's at home, or the people who are at home are not your safe people. But a library is a safe place. People can go, they can read the book, they can check it out if they want, read the section, put it away, come back to it if they need to, in a safe place. And people who don't have the funds to purchase the book, or they have those barriers, like that's a way that we can help people, as if this book is in every library. So call your local library or ask your college library to carry a copy of the book. It makes a big difference.
I love the call to action. God, I love it so much.
I'm going to include this maybe in the show notes, or we can put it on the website or something. We will type up just a type form, same as like contact your senators, contact your local library. Here's the script. Here's the link. Here's how you ask for it, and ask for it to be in a safe place that's accessible. That thought had not crossed my mind. I mean, they do, but not like this specific guidebook might not be safe in your home if you are not safe in your home. There's so many things that we don't think about, but that is just genius. Thank you for saying that so eloquently. We will put something together so that you can easily contact your local library, resource center, campus, wherever it might be. But let's get this in the hands of as many people as possible.
Thank you. Thank you for that support too. And thank you to everyone who participates. It makes a difference.
So for those of you that are listening, that are thinking, yes, absolutely, I want more of this, I want more of Cheyenne, where can they find you? Where can they find your content? How can they follow along with what you're doing?
On Instagram, I'm We Are The Evidence, and my website's the same, We Are The Evidence, so feel free to reach out. I'm also on LinkedIn, and I have a very small activity on TikTok. So you can follow me on most platforms, and feel free to send me messages or interact as you feel comfortable.
And then the book is available now. Tell us everywhere that it's available, all of the ways that it can be consumed right now, if people want to purchase it right now, like I did.
There's an ebook version, there's a paperback and an Audible version or audiobook version, and you can listen to audiobook wherever you listen to your audiobooks. And you should be able to order the paperback pretty much anywhere you buy your books. It's at Barnes & Noble. That was the most surreal experience, going and buying it. And the day of the book launch, that's what I did. I went and bought it, pulled it from the shelf, purchased it, and then put it in a little library, like those little free libraries around town.
Oh, I love it.
So yeah, you can find it really wherever you buy your books.
That's like another fun little call to action too. Like what a fun way to just, you know, if you have an extra little bit of money and you want to buy yourself a copy and then buy a copy for a free library near you, how fun would that be? I love that.
It's been really fun.
Okay, so now maybe I need to buy my copy and the audiobook and then an extra copy. It's a write-off.
It's a write-off. The write-off, people. If you do that, make sure you put it in your stories. Tag Cheyenne. Tag us. We will repost all of those if you all find those at your local bookstores, Barnes & Noble, wherever books are sold. That is just, I love this for you and for every single person who's going to benefit from the work, blood, sweat, and tears and time that you have put into this, along with the other survivors and experts. So thank you for doing this work and sharing your heart with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really appreciate you both.
Survivor's Guide to True Crime is hosted and executive produced by Kimberly Corbin Rourke and Kara Robinson Chamberlain. If you love what we do here, please don't forget to follow, rate, and review the show in your podcast player. It's an easy and free way to help us and help more people find the show. To learn more about the guests featured or to find resources and information discussed on the show, visit survivorsguidetotruecrime.com. Thanks for listening.
Well, see you later.